Notre Dame burned down. But Easter will go on as scheduled because they saved the crown of thorns that was around Christ's head. I've been asked all week long, got 1,000 emails or texts of what my feelings is on it. And I got to be honest with you, I'm kind of torn between the two. I mean, I have no love for the Catholic Church, and I certainly have no love for the... But from a historical standpoint, that sucker had been around 900 and some years. And any, you know, hey, I get upset and emotional when 4 or 5, 6 years ago, down the end of my street in Raytown, they cut down a tree to make the road wider that was 175 years old. I mean, that to me, that's a tragedy. I mean, but, you know, and then on top of that, I mean, what's the hunchback going to do for a job now? He's out. Oh, Byrie, what is brown and wrinkled and lives in a bell tower? The lunch bag of Notre Dame. Okay. Anyway, it's gone. Don't bother going to Paris to see it. Go to Normandy. It's a lot more exciting. Who's got the first question tonight? Who wants to get us rocking and rolling tonight? Let's get Charles right here. First, Charles, go ahead.
Hello.
Okay. So I'm reading through Romans.
In Romans?
Chapter 14.
Okay, let's get there. Romans chapter 14.
Verses 20 through 22.
20 through 22. It says, for meat destroy not the work of God, all things indeed are pure, but it is evil for that man which who eateth with offense. It is good neither to eat flesh nor to drink wine, nor anything whereby thy brother stumbleth, or is offended, or is made weak. Hast thou faith? Have it to thyself before God. Happy is he that commendeth not himself in that thing which condemneth himself, not himself, in that thing which he alloweth. Okay?
So basically, I was wondering, mainly in the verses about meat and eating, I don't know what he's really talking about there.
Okay, Charles, that's a great question. Now, as you know, the book of Romans is the book of doctrine for the church. And we go through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, which are the historical books transferring in. Book of Acts is a transitioning book that brings us into the church age, Acts chapter 20. And then in the book of Romans, which is the next book, Paul begins to lay out everything the church is to do. It's an incredible book. And it's one at some point in your life, if you're ever going to move off dead center, you're going to have to get down pretty good. I must tell you, Romans is probably... for understanding it, is probably one of the hardest books in the Bible, though none of them are really hard. It's the way Paul writes it. And once you get past that and see that, then it pretty much will unfold itself. I've laid out Romans for you on the website chapter by chapter. That makes it a lot easier for you. His question is in chapter 14. And in chapter 14, as in every chapter in Romans, he deals with a specific subject that we have to deal with as a Christian in the New Testament church. In chapter 14, we as Christians and are dealing with other Christians. And what he's dealing with here will be really anything, but he uses a specific example of somebody who is a vegetarian versus somebody that is not. And what he's saying in verse 20 here, as he's coming down through here, he says, verse 20, for meat destroy not the work of God. All things indeed are pure, but it is evil for that man who eateth with offense. What he's saying is, when you start dealing with Christians, you're going to find maybe Christians who don't have the light that you have about something. Now here, it's meat versus being a vegetarian, but it could be anything. And what he's saying here is the fact in verse 20, for meat. In other words, you know that it's okay to eat meat, that there's nothing biblical or spiritual about being a vegetarian versus eating meat. And that's what he says in verse 20. For meat destroyeth not the work of God. All things are indeed or pure. What he's saying there, that to God it doesn't matter. In the church age, you can eat meat if you choose to do that. You can choose to eat meat or not eat meat and be a vegetarian. You can find yourself somewhere in between. It's your own choice. There's no hard line doctrine on it in the New Testament church. Obviously, in the Old Testament, there were some limitations to what you could eat. It looks like in the Garden of Eden before the fall, they were vegetarian. And then after the fall, it looks like they're not. They can eat. But even that, once Israel gets established, there are certain things that they cannot eat which are unclean. In the New Testament church, all things are pure. What he means by that is that you can eat whatever you want to eat. You can choose to be a vegetarian or you can choose to eat meat. Obviously, there's health issues. Probably you're better off on leaning on the vegetarian side, obviously, but that's your choice. He doesn't get into that in the New Testament where he sets down any deal. He'll give you the principles. He'll show you, you know, some things that, and then you have to decide based on what you do. What he's saying in chapter 14 is, he's saying, verse 20, let's break them down. For meat destroy not the work of God. When you know that it's okay to eat meat, don't flaunt that into a younger Christian's life who doesn't understand that yet. And that's how you would destroy the work of God, by destroying that person. You have a young Christian that he thinks a vegetarian is the way to go. You know better than that. But you don't clobber him with that or, you know, make fun of him or, you know, belittle him for that. Give him time to grow and come to those conclusions himself. And what he's saying in verse 20, don't destroy that person or the work of God over vegetarianism versus eating meat. He says, because you know that all things are pure, you can do that. But, last part of the verse, but it is evil for that man who eateth with offense. A younger Christian doesn't see it that way in many cases. Now, again, he's using the concept of vegetarian versus meat eaters, but it could be a lot of things. He's just using that as a standard example that you would apply in many other areas in your world. And, you know, so you realize that under the New Testament law, all things are lawful. Under New Testament grace, excuse me, all things are lawful. You can pretty much do within the structure of the doctrine of the New Testament pretty much anything you want to do. You'll find growing up in Christianity, to give a good example, would be in my day growing up, you don't see it much anymore because times have changed. But back in the day, in the 60s and the 70s, if you went to a movie theater, you were on your way to hell. As a Christian, movie theaters were terrible, and you just didn't go to movies. And if you did go to movies, you picked one out of town where nobody saw you. And so it's a thing where, now there was nothing wrong with going to the movies. And the reasoning is because, you go to a good movie, you're supporting the bad ones. And that sounds spiritual, but that's a young Christian's take on it that doesn't really have much wisdom involved in it. Because if that's true and you follow your convictions all the way to the end, then you're not going to go to a restaurant to eat that sells liquor. You certainly are going to be out of gas and have to walk the rest of your life, because where do you find a gas station that doesn't sell cigarettes and doesn't sell liquor and doesn't sell gambling deals, whatever they're called, lottery, yeah. And so you paint yourself into a corner. And this is what young Christians do who don't have the light that we have. And yet, back in the day, it was so absurd. I remember that Bob Jones University came out with a series of movies that were based on Christian concepts. And they were really good. And, and they were being shown in churches. And obviously the question comes up, well, what's the difference between that than going to a movie theater? And here's the answer that the pastors gave, and it's really stupid. Here's the answer. One is a movie, and the other is a film. Now, you're laughing, but that's exactly what they said. When you go to a theater, you're going to a movie. When you see it in the church, it's a film. I picked it up very quickly. You know, it's a thing when you say movie, God goes. When you say film, God goes. That's how it works. We had an issue back in my day with long hair. The hippie movement was coming to an end, but all the kids had long hair, guys. And there were actually young men who would come to church and their hair would be long. And, you know, short hair is back in now. You don't see it much. Every once in a while you do, which is cool. But it's a thing where back in the day, if I remember, we had an athletic program. We had a basketball league to reach young people. And I want to tell you something. We had a guy who was in charge of that who was old school, old school, old school, old school. And if a kid came to play on a Friday night and his hair touched his ear or was below his collar, he was asked to leave and he couldn't play. And that's the mindset they had back then. Because, you know, and then I remember this. And I figured, you know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but my claim to fame that I am the smartest one in the slow class. And I picked things up quick. I remember watching this preacher preach one time, and he was really preaching good. And he was going to town. And he's a good preacher. But he was working up a lather. He was sweating all over the place. And suddenly he turned around and he's just preaching and his hair is just all down in his face and he just smooths it back. And I got it. It wasn't how long your hair was that was a sin. It was the placement of your hair. You took a hair and put it straight back, God was pleased. You take that same hair, flip it over your ear, God is now not pleased. And I began way back in the day to see how stupid things were and why they did things like that. And of course, you know, so you can use this example in many, many other areas. If I would have been running that program back in that day and a kid would have came with hair, and really, the cares were... It was nothing. I mean, I would have not said a word to the person and just let him hang around, come and go. What happens is when you send him back, he gets mad. He doesn't ever come to church again. I do the same thing with the Bible. Is there anybody on planet Earth who believes the King James Bible is the Word of God more than me? I don't think so. But at the same time, I've had people come to this church or in my ministry over the years who had another Bible. An NIV or something, whatever they was. And I never clobbered them. And I, you know what? I have learned that, you know, I understand the issue. Maybe they don't. And I realized that if I made a big deal about it, they're never going to come back. They're never going to find the truth. So what's the deal? It's no big deal. Let them bring it. And if they're really interested, then God will give them the truth. I'd much rather God give somebody the truth about something than me have to do it. And it just works that way. And this is what you've got here. This is what he's saying. He's saying to you, you know it's okay. But to the person that's a young baby Christian, it's an evil thing. And so don't destroy the work of God for that sake. Then he says in verse 21, it is good neither to eat flesh nor to drink wine nor anything whereby thy brother stumbleth or is offended or is made weak. He's simply saying, be conscious of this kid's weakness. Don't flaunt yourself. If I was going to go out to lunch or dinner with somebody that was a vegetarian, I probably wouldn't order a 28, 32-ounce porterhouse. You know, I'd get it to go and pick it up on the way out. I'd be conscious where he's at with it. And, you know, because the goal is to win him. And so you just take your time. And he says in verse 22, hast thou faith? Have it to thyself before God. Now, the faith here isn't faith to be saved. The faith here is to trust God that all things are pure, up here in verse 20. And he says, happy is he that condemneth not himself in the thing which he alloweth. In other words, if I know it's okay to eat meat and you're a vegetarian and we're going to spend some time together, I'm not going to flaunt it in your face and condemn myself because of your weakness. I'll be tolerant of where you're at. I'll help you with it. Now, that doesn't mean that I go vegetarian with you. It means that I work with you to help you get to a point. If there comes a point in time where you can't get to that, well, then after a while, I'm getting a Big Mac. It's on you. It's a thing where, you know, but you don't come out of the gate with a young Christian who is weak in the faith in some things and just roll them over like a steamroller. You understand where they're coming from. You help them. And, you know, I've had things in my message that I was going to preach, and somebody showed up on a Sunday morning that was maybe a Roman Catholic, and it was somebody's family. And, you know, and I could easily get up and just said, well, I'm just going to blast them out. Yeah, but I can say the same thing by moving around it without offending that person. And that's what I'm going to do, because I'm not going to let my preaching, which is designed to edify people, be something that somebody says, you know what, he attacked my religion, so I'm not going to come back. Now, there are times that there's an exception to that. But if I see somebody out there and I know that I'm going to say something that they may offend them and make it hard for you or to reach them, or then I'm going to back off a little bit and I will say what I need to say, but I'll find another way to say it that's a non-offensive way. And you can do that with just about everything. Sometimes we just like being offensive. I know I do. And it's a thing where, you know, you got to be careful with those things. And, you know, and then there's other times out there that I'll see somebody that I'll blast them. And I'll give you an example. Have I got an Easter message for you on Sunday? And I'm going to tell you, it doesn't matter on this coming Sunday. It doesn't matter. It's going to come down the line. It doesn't matter. I'm not sparing anybody. I mean, it's a thing where, you know, Easter is Easter. And I'm tired of people who come only on Easter because they want to celebrate the resurrection, and the resurrection was the greatest thing in our salvation is based on, and the resurrection, he says in Philippians, is the power of his resurrection, and that power is to change your life. So you're going to show up on that day that's the day we're going to say is the Christ resurrected, and then you're going to come and celebrate one day a year, the resurrection that could change your life, but you live your life the rest of the year not changed? Oh, it's going to be a good time Sunday. Anyway, then he says in verse 22, hast thou faith, have it to thyself before God. Happy is he that condemneth not himself in the thing which he alloweth. And so he's basically giving him instructions that don't be a stumbling block to a younger Christian because you have the light on something that you know you can do, but he doesn't have the light yet. That's basically what he's saying. That's a great question, Charles. Good question. Good question. Next question. Yes, sir, back there.
It will be Revelation 2, verse 6.
2:6. It says, but this thou hast, that thou hatest the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate.
Yeah, and I've heard conflicting views on what the doctrine of the Nicolaitans was, and I was just curious, because he clearly hates it. I'd like to know what exactly
it
is.
The Nicolaitan here, when he says doctrine of the Nicolaitans, that is a combination of two words. It's a combination of Nico, which is Latin for conquer, and the Laos, which is laity. And it's a doctrine which is found in the Roman Catholic Church, and this is where it starts here in the church at Ephesus. Later, you notice that it becomes a full-fledged teaching here as the Pergamus comes in. And it simply means that there's a priest class, like the Roman Catholic Church, that actually conquers the laity. Who asked me right before Bible study about, oh, it was you, about Father. Yeah. You did a job in somebody's house, and he was a Roman Catholic priest, and he was Father, and he wanted you to put on the bill Father Shenanigans or something like that. And you didn't put Father down. You just put Admiral whatever. And he asked me about why they're called Father. And so it's a great connection here. And that's why. The Roman Catholic Church teaches that the priest class is a hierarchy of intellectual that elevates the priest class over the common man. And the common man would be the normal walk-in-the-mill Roman Catholics who fall under the hierarchy. And the doctrinal Nicolaitans would be that hierarchy. Starts with the priests, then it runs to the bishops, then it runs to the cardinals, then it runs to the archbishops, then it runs to the pope. And, you know, that's the hierarchy. And that is, at the lowest level, we have the priests who are pastoring over the laity, over them, so they're called fathers, because the laity is looked at as the children of the church, so the priests are the fathers to the children. And that starts actually back here very early in church history. And notice here it says verse 6. It says the deeds of the Nicolaitans. Over here a little bit farther, when you get into the next church period, Pergamus, look at verse 15. Now thou hast also them that hold the doctrine. See? It went from just something they were doing early in the church at Ephesus, which is around 100 A.D., now by 325 with Constantine, who starts the Roman Catholic Church. Shortly after that, it becomes a doctrine. And that doctrine is the priest class over the laity, which goes in different levels, starting with the fathers or the priest. And by the way, in Matthew chapter, I think it's 23, Jesus told the religious leaders at that day that you were to call no man father upon the earth. And he's talking about religious leaders, not your daddy. And so it's a thing where this is where it starts. So the Nicolaitan doctrine or the deeds is that beginning of the Roman Catholic hierarchy, which is going to take precedent over the common man and control him. And there's not a lot of difference between the Catholic Church and the communist movement. They're both totalitarian systems. All the big guys on top, all the little guys on the bottom. And a lot more little guys than there are big guys. And those big guys, in both cases, control everything. And so that's why you find the way it lays itself out. So just remember, the Nicolaitans is a combination of two words. Nico, conquer, laos, or the laity, to conquer the laity. And it's simply a priest class over. Back in the early church, when you go back in church history, you'll find that the early Bible preachers, like Nestorius and those guys, they were faced with this. And the teaching was falling around, you know, that the preachers were spiritually over the people. And this was the beginning of this. It was all coming out of Alexandria. And guys like Nestorius, guys like those early guys, would not follow that. So they pulled out and were labeled as heretics in time goes on. But they began that first new Bible line that carried its way all the way through. So that's what it is, Jeff. Yeah, go ahead. Who's got the mic? He's back. Got another question.
So just so that I understand this better, because this is like 1895 when he's talking about these things happening. Catholic Church hasn't yet formed, but the doctrines are still there within the church, basically, is what you're saying?
No. If you look at the words, when it's first becoming laid out in around 80, 90, 100 in verse 6, it doesn't say doctrine. It says deeds. It was a teaching at that time, and it began to be taught then. But it wasn't official a doctrine till you get into the Pergamos church period, which is in verse 12, which brings us up to the time of Constantine, 300, 400 AD, where the Catholic Church becomes officially sanctioned. And then they make it a doctrine.
Okay, yeah. I see that. And just real quick, I see that 14 is talking about the doctrine of Balaam there you was talking about. And
yes.
Talking about committing things sacrificed unto idols. Would that be anything tied to the Eucharist and the Roman?
That's exactly what it is.
Coincidental that they're
combined
right there?
That's exactly what it is. The Mass and eating the Eucharist, and that's exactly what it is. You got it, buddy. You got it. You got it. Yes, ma'am.
1 Peter 3:7.
What is it?
1 Peter 3:7.
Before you do that, is there any other questions about that one before I go on here? Or bring it down to here, and then we'll come back to you. I don't want to.
Yeah. Well, wow. okay, so you went over that.
Did you take your pants back because they're missing?
Trying to fill them up again. No. So you went over this a while back about the deeds and the doctrine, and you gave us one before that. It started before the deeds, and I thought it was in like verse 4.
Well, verse 4 is where they begin to leave the Bible for their foundational teaching, and this is what leads to all of this stuff. Yeah. Yeah, this is where, and here again, this is where the first, you got Clement of Rome, who, in his writings, and he's a saved man. I mean, in his writings, he talks about us being a son of the church. So you can see where, if you're a son of the church, then there has to be a father over the church, which is the priest. So you start to see this thing creep in with guys who begin to, they believe the Bible. But they begin to use non-scriptural terms, non-biblical terms, and it's like Irenaeus was the first guy who used the word Catholic, and he used it in a universal sense. But that's a classical concept, and so the Catholic Church took that because they look at the Catholic Church as the universal church, and when you try to call them on it, they'll run back to the early church fathers, who was a saved guy, and said he understood the Catholic. So that's what they do. So that's where it starts when it says there they left their first love. That's the word of God. Once they do that, then the gates are open, and you can do whatever you want to do, and that's how the devil did what he did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You betcha.
John.
Yeah.
So I can't remember where I read this, but it had to do with the Nicolaitans and Constantine, when he started to form the Catholic Church, started to build these cathedrals. Notre Dame just made me think of that. And they would have an area in the church where the priest would be, and then they'd have a fence, and then all the laity was behind that, and it represented them being separated from the normal people. I was wondering if you had heard of that. Or
I've never heard of that, but they did it in many other ways. One of the best ways they did it is the way they dressed.
Right.
See, I mean, I dress just like you. I have a priest outfit at home, but I don't usually wear it. But they wanted to distinguish themselves, that they were connected better than you were, and they simply do it by the clothes that they wear. So there's a many different ways. I've never heard that particular one, but I don't doubt it. I'm sure that there's many ways that they that they executed that to put themselves over the common people. Yeah. Okay, back to Joy now.
One more on the same topic.
Okay.
So why is it that this word laity, why do people say, when they talk about people in church as being the, quote, lay people? I thought everybody in the church, if you're saved, are priests.
Well, it's not in that sense of a priest. It's in the sense of a bishop, a pastor. A pastor is separated from the people, which are still lay people, because they've never been ordained. But he's not over them in any way, shape, or form other than the New Testament as a pastor. And the Bible makes it very clear that he's not the Lord over his people. He's to be one of them and to be to them what they need to be, but he's one of them. The only thing that sets him apart is the fact that he has been ordained under the New Testament guidelines to be a bishop or a pastor. Now, the word bishop, usually initially in the Bible, was a pastor, but Baptists shy away from it because the Catholic Church picked it up, and so we don't call pastors bishops anymore, even though that is the biblical term for it. An ordained elder is a bishop, and the ordination process is the putting on of hands by the leadership of the church to set somebody apart as a pastor or a bishop. But because of the Catholic Church concept of bishops, the Baptists don't use it, haven't used it. I've never known that they have used it for a long time. But they're set apart as far as their ordination to pastor a church. So the laity there is lay people, but the pastor doesn't conquer them. Well, no, some Baptist pastors do, but he's not supposed to. So that's what you got.
So we're supposed to call you Bishop Bob.
Bishop. Okay, Joy.
1 Peter 3:7.
That's right, 1 Peter 3:7. It says, likewise, ye husbands, dwell with them, talking about the wife here, according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife, as under the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered.
Why is them used as plural instead of, like, dwell with her? And then
where is it?
It says, ye husbands, dwell with them. Is the them referring to the wife?
To all wives, yes. In other words, all husbands.
In general.
And all wives.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not talking about one particular husband, one particular wife. He's talking in a general sense. Okay. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church. It's okay. a broad stroke.
And then at the end of that, it says that your prayers be not hindered.
Yes.
Is that just for the husband, or does that apply
for
the wife?
Well, it would be in any relationship where the role of the husband and the role of the wife is not played out in a biblical sense. What happens is that a husband and wife are supposed to be so connected as a help meet, not a mate, as we've talked about many times, that when they're not, then the work that they're trying to do for God will get hindered, and their prayer life will get hindered. Many times when it gets out of whack, they'll change roles. The husband will become the submissive one, and the wife will become the dominant one. And you see that all the time, where the woman runs the family. And so God can't work through that, because it's so your prayer life, as far as, it's not saying that God won't answer your prayers, it's just saying in the aspect of ministry or doing what you need to do, it's going to be hindered. So, in other words, it's just like everything that God created and put into a movement has to go by an ordered structure. When it gets outside that ordered structure, then it breaks down. And when it breaks down, everything breaks down. And so that's what he's talking about. That excellent question, though. Excellent question. Get back here. This little gal's had her hand up here for a while.
Okay. I'm so scared. Okay. No, I got it.
Can you explain to me what Mormons believe and how it's different from us Christians?
I'm sorry, honey?
Can you explain to me what Mormons believe and how it's different from us Christians?
I'm sorry?
Can you explain the difference?
Oh, okay. Her question is what Mormons believe and how it differs from us. First of all, the main difference between the Mormon church and, let's just say, the Baptist church, but we could also say any Christian church, but we're Baptist, so we'll talk about us. The main difference is that you can trace the Baptist church back to where they're first called Christians in Antioch. And back in early times, you know, you had men like Nestorius that we just talked about who were pastors, and they were faced with some of the things that were changing, and they stayed true to it. And their enemies called their followers after the individual man that they followed. They followed Nestorius, so they called them Nestorians. And so you see that happening. As time moves on and Christianity spreads, the Roman Catholic Church now begins to call the true Christian line after the geographical location in Europe that they lived in. The Huguenots were in France. The Waldensians were in Italy. The Lombards were in North Italy. And so you find that as it even gets more, by the 1500s, Christianity has spread and gotten so massive, and there's such a thorn in the Roman Catholic side that now they call them based on the number one doctrine that they're fighting over. And originally, they're called Anabaptist, Anna being against, Pedro being child or baby, Baptist being baptism, because the true line was against infant baptism for salvation, and they were against any baptism for salvation. So the Roman Catholic Church didn't call them by the guy they were following because there was too many of them. Couldn't call them by the geographical location because they were over Europe like melted butter on popcorn. I mean, they were all over the place. So they picked the doctrine that was the number one doctrine that they stood for. Later it became Anabaptist, and then by 1500, 1600, it just became Baptist. But the Baptist line goes back through that true line all the way back. Now, I say that clearly telling you that today most Baptists are off the wall, and I appreciate them taking it off their name of their church because they're so screwed up. But fundamentally, going back through history, and I don't have time to give you all of that, the Baptist church goes back through the Anabaptist, back through the Anabaptist, back through the Waldensians, the Albigensians, and the Huguenots, and the Polycians, right back to the Nestorians, and all that group back there. The main difference between the Mormon church and the Baptist church is the Mormons are found no place in history before 1835. And in 1835, Joseph Smith finds these golden tablets that were given to him by a demon angel, Moriah, and he now starts the Mormon faith or the Mormon church. So the greatest difference between the two is the fact that the Mormon church has no history to it because it's a satanic religion that was born out of a demonic relationship with Joseph Smith and a little later on Brigham Young, to start very early. And they spend millions and millions of dollars going back in these genealogy centers desperately trying to find their heritage back in time. And they come up with some of the goofiest stuff on the planet. They are very radical, even though they want to appear to be normal. And they, if you would pin them down on their teaching, they believe that white people, Caucasians, are of the children of God, and black people are children of the devil. And what they teach is that on a planet called Kolob out there someplace, the devil is fornicating with women and producing spirits that are black spirits, and the white spirits are someplace else. And when a white man is born, the white spirit goes in from God. When a black man is born or woman, then they get the devil's spirit in them, and that's what they teach, and that's what they believe. And that's as serious as a heart attack. So I'm just telling you. So if nothing else, that answers a lot of questions with Alex back here. We got, but anyway, just kidding. So they are so off the wall that they believe in baptism for salvation. But here again, it's baptism in their church by their people, not just any baptism. And they also teach that if you had an uncle or an aunt or a brother or a sister that was not a Mormon and they died, that you can get baptized for them. This is called baptism of the dead, and get them in after the fact, which is a good deal if it worked. But so they are so far out of whack that, but they're like all other cults. They, down through history, they've had to continually readjust their position doctrinally as Baptists kicked their rear ends. And it got to the point where they split shortly after getting started. And this is why you have a group out in Utah, and then you have a group here in Independence. And everybody knows where the big tower is over here in Independence. And that is because they believe that when Jesus Christ comes back, he's coming back to Independence, Missouri. And the tower there is for his landing, I guess, or whatever the case may be. I am sure that they have men stationed up on top with fluorescent gloves and little flashlights to line him in when they hear him coming. If I didn't want to be a Mormon for any other reason, then there's lots of reasons why I wouldn't be a Mormon. I've given you a bunch of them. My main reason is if Jesus Christ, your Jesus Christ, when he comes back, is coming to Independence, Missouri, I don't want anything to do with him. I mean, I love Independence, Missouri, home of Harry Truman and all that stuff. I get it. But if that's the best he can do. But you see, the reason why they teach that, and here's another difference, is because they believe that God is finished with the Jew, as all cults do. And they believe that they have taken the place as the true church, as all cults do. So it's a, you know, the differences are glaring. You're going to find that they're very subtle today. They have changed the names of their churches to normal names. And they don't let you know that they're Mormons until you get in there and you like it. They're very family orientated. One of the greatest models of Mormonism at its best undercover is Glenn Beck, who for many, 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 many years was the stable conservative on Radio Talk that took a stand for all the right things. He's a Mormon. Now, he doesn't come up and tell anybody that because he wants such a following that you get hooked with his good stuff that he says, and then you find out, you know, he cloaks that, the fact that he's, you know, he's a Mormon. And it's a very, very, very wild deal. So there's many, many differences, but those would be the main ones that, you know, that the Mormon church is nothing to do with anything biblical, spiritual, God, Jesus Christ, but everything to do with the devil. So, somebody else back here first before I get to your charge. Does somebody else have a question? Okay, over here. Go to Jenny.
There's another question on it.
Okay.
It was just basically like, is there the difference between the Mormons and the Latter-day Saints?
Like, I'm sorry?
Why do they use the two different names?
Because they split.
Yeah, and that's...
Yeah, the Latter-day Saints are one group, and then the Mormons are the other group when they split back in the day of their split. Which one guy said to the other, let's split. Which we say today, let's split. We got to go. And if they wanted to get away fast, it was lickety-split. What happened? She changed her mind? What? What are we doing?
No, I thought she had another question.
Oh, okay.
My sister and I are studying the outlines from the bookstore, and we started with the introduction.
Okay, whoa. Outlines of what? We don't have an outline of the bookstore. You walk in there and everything's on the racks.
I'm sorry, Bible Basics.
Okay.
And we started with the introduction before Genesis, and in that you talked about how in Exodus 21 through 35, you can get, I'm sorry, 25 through 31, you can get the dimensions of the universe.
Okay.
And it gives, so we have two questions, and I don't know how you're going to answer it, but my question is, how do you get...
I'll tell you right now, not very well, but go ahead.
How do you get the dimensions of the universe out of the tabernacle?
Yes.
And then my sister wants to know, if God can do anything, why did the tabernacle have to be made of gold and... silver and brass and onyx and blue and purple and have to be a certain way so that God could be with the Jews?
I'm not sure how that fits in if God can do anything.
Well,
because God could do anything, because that's the way he did it.
Well, we were telling her that that he told the Jews that it had to be this certain way.
Right.
In order for him to be with her.
Okay.
Or be with them. And she wasn't understanding why it had to be that certain way in order for God to be with them.
And I'm just going to give you an example now. When it comes to your salvation, are you saved?
Yes.
You are? You sure? You kind of hesitate.
Yes. Okay. Yes, no, I am.
Okay. We can. Here we go. Just as I am. Come forward today and trust Jesus.
No, really.
Healed of whatever you got. Okay.
No, really.
My point is this. You are saved.
Yes, sir.
But there had to be a certain way God told you to be saved or you didn't get saved.
That's true.
You're right, it's true. I'm always true. My point is, just as God had an exact way he wanted Israel to do things for him to be fellowshipping with them, he has an exact way that he wants you and I to do things to have fellowship with him.
Okay.
In other words, God is an exact God. Now, to add to that, and that's a great question. It's a very good question. To add to that, everything that is in there is some manifestation and a picture of who God really is. Romans chapter 1, Romans chapter 1 verse 20 says, the invisible things of him are clearly seen and understood by the thing God made. So when he made that tabernacle, that tabernacle is a type of the universe. So somehow, and I don't know how to answer this, somehow those dimensions of that formulate into the dimensions of the universe because that tabernacle is a picture of that. The tabernacle has three levels, and the universe has the first heaven, second heaven, and third heaven. The tabernacle has an outer court, inner court, holy of holies. So it's a picture of that. But I don't have a clue to the key to be able to put that all together. But what I do can tell you is this. Everything in that tabernacle overlaid with gold, deity of Christ, wood, the humanity of Christ. It all means something. So God, when he gives man what he wants him to do, patterns it after himself. So it has to be exact because he's exact. And just like it had to be exact for them to do that, to honor him, salvation for you and me has to be exactly the way he says to do it. And any other way won't work. Yeah, it's a great question, but it's when you just look at the answer, it's pretty simple how it works. Now, back to my original question. Are you sure you're saved?
Yes.
Okay, because your husband was shaking his head. He didn't think you were. Okay, maybe he's not saved. Maybe you had to work on him. Okay.
Okay, Pam has a question.
Whoa, hey.
And how much did that cost her?
Next week, maybe. Other hands? Okay.
Come on down to this one here. We'll get.
I'm sorry, Charles.
Gosh, Pam. I just want to know how you got that message from here to here. Oh, texting probably.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, she got a piece of paper.
She does. I'm asking a question for somebody else. What happened
to... We don't allow that here.
Okay.
Go ahead.
It's for Gail. It's for Gail.
Ah! Okay. Miss size 52. Go ahead.
Okay. What happened to Jesus, his physical flesh body after coming out of the tomb? That's part one. And basically, what did he look like after he was resurrected? I know in Matthew 28, he talks about he's white and shining, but just kind of more details on that along those lines.
Well, I'll give you what I can. Obviously, when, you know, he dies and he's put in the tomb, and when he resurrects, he's still in a physical body. And that physical body, there's four or five different bodies that Jesus has in the Bible. And before he goes in, when he's crucified, that's one of the bodies. When he comes out of that tomb after the resurrection, that's another body. And then he comes back a little bit later on, and that is another body. And then he comes back at the second coming of Christ, and that is another body. And then out into eternity, he has another body. And then in the Old Testament, he has a body. And then in Genesis 1:1, he has another kind of body. So you have to understand that to see how this thing is going. When he dies on the cross, he's a human flesh and blood. He's a human man, even though he's the Godhead. Somebody asked me the other day, it was on my Lincoln Bible study, a great question. Somebody asked me the difference between the Son of God and the title Son of God and the Son of Man, which was an excellent question. Kids up at Lincoln are getting it. And I explained to them that Christ had two natures. He really has more than two, but to keep it simple, he has two natures. He was when he came to this earth, he was the Son of God. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. So he comes down as the Son of God. But he's a human man born through the line of the kings, through Mary. So he's human. So even though he is God, the Son of God, he's also a human man, the Son of Man. So it speaks to his two deal. When he's on the cross and the Roman soldier throws that spear in his side, John sees it, and the Bible says that the water and the blood comes out, and John said this testifies to something. When you get over in 1 John, he says he was born of the blood and the water. And there it is again. There's his two natures. The blood that he had in his veins was God's blood, Acts 20:28. So that made him the Son of God. But he came through the water birth of Mary, which made him the Son of Man. So you have those two natures. So when he dies on the cross, he dies as the Son of God and the Son of Man as a human man. When he comes out of that tomb, now his body looks the same, but now he has no blood. Now he shows up, and when he meets Thomas, Thomas says, I don't believe it. He says, feel the marks of my hands and my side. He still had the wounds, but he wouldn't stand there bleeding over everybody. He had no blood. Now that's significant to all these bodies represent something in the Bible. So, but remember, when he came out of the tomb, he told them not to touch him. So he couldn't be touched. So when he comes back 3 or 4 hours later, they're touching him all over the place and handling him. And the reason, and that's another body, the reason why they couldn't touch him because he had not yet ascended to the Father to present himself as the sacrifice. And if human hands would have touched him, it would have defiled that sacrifice. Once he goes to heaven and comes back, and it's not in the Bible where he does, it just he tells you he did. Once he does that and he comes back, then they're free to handle him and touch him and hug him and whatever, because he's been to the Father. But then when you get to the second coming of Christ in the book of Revelation, he comes back as the glorified Christ, white as the sun, white as the light, and that's another body he has. So all through that, his physical appearance doesn't change. What changes about him is the progression of coming from the human man back to the glorified Christ. And that process is he dies on the cross as the Son of Man. He gets buried in the tomb like a regular human being, but he raises from the dead, and when he raises from the dead, now he's got a different body. He still looks the same, but he has no blood. And then a little bit later on, he can't be touched. He goes up to the Father and comes back. He still has no blood. He still looks the same, but now he can be handled. And then you have the glorified Christ, which you see in Matthew in the Mount of Transfiguration, and then again in Revelation 1, and then again in when he comes back as a glorified Christ. So he looks the same. Nothing changed about his appearance. What changed was the going through that process of from the human Son of Man up to the glorified Christ. So, that help you, Gail? Well, no, you had to tell her, and she has to ask it. No, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. So, actually, it's Kelly's question, really.
I know.
So, the second part to that was, okay, so when he...
If it's Kelly's question, you can ask as many as you want.
Oh, good. Okay, so everybody just sit back. I got the mic.
Okay.
So when Thomas saw him, and he had the nail prints in his hands, and then he went to the Father and came back, and then they said, okay, you can touch me now. Is he now at that point in his glorified body?
Not glorified yet.
Okay.
He's not shining white as the light at this point.
Okay.
But he's in his spiritual body coming back from the Father. He still has the nail prints in his hands.
Okay.
I think if you look it up, that encounter with Thomas takes place after he goes up and comes back.
Okay.
Not before.
So his spiritual body and his glorified body are totally different.
No, they're the same. His glorified body is a spiritual body, but his spiritual body that you find here has not been glorified yet.
Okay. Oh. Perfect. Thank you.
Finally. Just a quick question on what you were saying earlier. So how you said the Mormons or any other cult or church, they think that they're done with, God is done with the Jews, and he's obviously not. So if he's not, where do we play into that?
Where do we play into that?
Yeah, his plan and everything.
And that's a great question. Here again, Charles, this is where a Mormon, Jehovah Witness, a Roman Catholic, any of these cults could never do this because fundamentally they all reject the Bible, so they can't get anything out of the Bible. If we would step back and look at it, we would find that from Genesis to Revelation is God's plan. Within that plan, you're going to find that God has two identities that he works through. In the Old Testament, it's the nation of Israel. In the Old Testament, the nation of Israel is likened to God's wife, okay? She commits spiritual fornication on him, and so God gives her a bill of divorcement, and God divorces himself from her. And so as we speak from 606 BC up to the end of the tribulation period when the nation of Israel comes back, God has separated himself from his wife, Israel, okay? She's on her own. The second identity would be the body of Christ, the church. Now, as the nation of Israel is God's wife, The church is Christ's bride. So see, you have one identity for God the Father, another identity for the church, for Christ. So as we move this through, to keep it simple, right now God is estranged from his wife, the nation of Israel. And while he's estranged, Christ is calling out the church to be his bride. Down the line someplace, when the rapture takes place, we are going to be married to Christ as his bride. God is going to bring Israel back to him and restore Israel to him as his wife. And then out through eternity, you'll have those two identities working as God sees fit to use them. The nation of Israel is connected to the kingdom of heaven, which is a literal, visible kingdom that was given to Israel back in Genesis. The church, their kingdom is a kingdom of God, which is a spiritual kingdom that when you and I got saved, we got born into. So you have two different identities, one to God, one to Christ, one physical, one spiritual, and God down through his plan, through the Bible, and on down through eternity, will wrap those plans around those two identities, one to God, one to Christ. But they will mesh together for the plan of God. Okay? You go back in the bookstore, and I think there's one copy left. I just took one to give to another young pastor. There's a book back there called All About the Bible. Here's, I got to look at it here. I don't want to give it the wrong title. Oh, the story of the Bible, okay? It lays out everything in there. You go back, and Rose will give you that for me, free, okay? And you get that, and you read that, and it'll answer all your questions. Then if you have any questions, get with me, and we'll sit down and talk about it, or you can ask me in Bible study. But start with that. And if you want to get a panoramic understanding of the Bible, I did that 2006, I think it was. So a long time ago. We did it on a New Year's Eve. We started at 6 o'clock, wheels up at 6, and we landed at about 12:30. And I just went through the whole thing. So it's also on DVD in there if you'd rather watch it on television, which I'm extendingly handsome back in those days. And Joe Christensen brought in a real TV camera like Channel 5 and Channel 9, and we really did a good job on it. So it's whatever one you're comfortable with. Did that help you understand it? Yeah, good.
All right, yeah, so Joey, when you were talking about, well, my brain's not really adding this up, because when you say he came down the first time to earth, and then when he like died and buried and then went up to be like the sacrifice, and then came back, my brain doesn't add it up, because it thinks that like when you say the second coming, my brain's like, but it's the third time he came down. So it's confusing to me, because I'm adding this up and I don't think it works.
No, I see what you're, I see where you're getting at. You're counting the time he went up to heaven and came back before the Father as the second time. Yeah, yeah, it's not. In the Bible, the Bible never prophesied that. The Bible only prophesied the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ. The intervention of him going up to the Father is not on the same parallel as the coming to this earth, first coming, and coming back into second coming. It's an intermediate thing. In fact, you could say that that would be the fourth coming, because the Bible says that he leads captivity captive, but he takes him up to heaven, yet he's back down in Acts chapter 1. So those aren't official comings as the Bible defines them. They're intermediate actions that he's doing something, but the two main focuses in the Bible on Christ will be the first coming, when he came down to this earth and was manifested, and then when he comes back at the second coming. Everything in between is not on the same par as those two. So you don't want to get in your brain that they're connected with those two. They are individual deals. In fact, you could go through it, because if the Bible is the Word of God, which we know that it is, and the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, then when we got our Bible, then he came back again. So you can't just look at every time he shows up. The Bible specifically prophesies two comings, the first coming and the second coming. Everything else in between is just the work that he's doing to accomplish what he's trying to accomplish. Excellent question, though. Good question. Nothing wrong with that.
1 Corinthians 5.
First, another question?
Yeah, total different question.
Okay, 1 Corinthians 5. Okay.
Well, the main point verse is verse 5, by 5.
Okay.
Verse 5 is the one I want to have read.
Okay, to deliver such a one unto Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus.
Okay, Paul's writing to this church, and this is my summary how I think it laid out here. I was trying to explain it for Cheryl. Paul's writing to the church saying, you guys aren't dealing with this particular person who's taking his father's wife and having his way with him, and you actually say it's okay. And he's trying to say you need to kick him out of the church.
Right.
So this is the kind of a kicking out of a church scenario. Can this also be applied like in a family? So if a father and mother see the child is not going to do right, and you got to turn them over to the world and for the destruction of their flesh if you believe they're saved or if they're not saved. I'm not even sure if that's the case.
Yeah, this is another case like the earlier case about the vegetarian and the meat eater. This is an example here that will fit many different scenarios. And the key that you want to follow here is don't get hung up on the guy and what he did. What you want to see is this is a biblical principle of how you deal with anybody who refuses to get right about anything. And there comes a time in any scenario, no matter what it may be, and yes, it can be a mom and a dad with a child. It can be in a lot of different scenarios that you have to. This is what happened with the prodigal son. They had to let him go, and he went and wound up in the pig pen, and it took the pig pen for him to realize what he needed and what he lost. And so sometimes, you know, the model here is sometimes you got to let him go so you can get him back. Now, unfortunately, letting them go doesn't always guarantee you're going to get them back. But that's the principle. And this is a last-ditch effort, by the way. When you've extended everything else and tried everything else, this is the turning them over to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus, is your final option. There is no guarantee that this is going to work. Now, it worked here because this guy gets right back in 2 Corinthians, then, you know, he tells him to restore this guy. But, you know, it doesn't always happen that way. But this is one of these places where you look at the what is happening, but it's a model of you can use in many scenarios where it's the last situation that you have. And if you don't, I've seen families that had 3 or 4 kids that one of the kids turned out was just going crazy and going terrible and back to the world. I mean, you couldn't control them at all. And, you know, the parents try everything. And at some point, you have to cut that kid loose to save the other 3. Because if you don't, that kid is going to destroy the rest of them. And what it does, it puts that kid into the place where they're now in a place where they can learn and the hard way about things. But it also is a lesson to the rest of the kids that you're not going to tolerate that, and the path for them will be the same as this kid if they don't do what they need to do. So it works as a tool, and it's a very good tool. Unfortunately, it's not always an effective tool, because many times when you get to this point, you know, it isn't going to happen. and kids. We had a lady in our church here a number of years ago. They left the church because of the fact that, you know, that we wouldn't buy into what she was trying to do. And many of you ladies, you know, she would go to and you would hold a line and tell her. She had a daughter who manipulated her in everything. I mean, it was terrible. And when the daughter didn't get what she wanted, they had one of the sweetest little grandkids you ever saw in your life. She held that grandkid hostage that, you know, grandma couldn't see her. Well, grandma was not very strong, and she'd always give in. And she'd wind up doing everything for this gal. And this gal did nothing for herself. And she would get depressed, you know, the mom. She would get depressed, you know, and she'd talk about, you know, committing suicide, and she can't do this. She'd have terrible time with it. And I talked to her on several occasions, told her exactly what she needed to do. I know some of the ladies in here held the line with her and told her the exact same thing. She could never do it. And so it became easier for her to, you know, blame us for the problem and then go someplace else with a, you know, she could, you know, find all the sympathy she wanted because the pastor's not very strong. And, you know, she could exist in that. But I told her, I said, your only hope here is to cut her off completely. And obviously it's going to, you're going to lose some things. You may not get to see the grandkid. I mean, she's going to retaliate. It isn't going to be, well, thank you for cutting me off because I know I really need to get something. No, it ain't going to go that way. It's going to get very ugly. But it's, at that stage of the game, there's nothing you can do. Enabling them is not the answer. You're enabling them is what got them into the mess to begin with. So at some place along the line, you've got to explain to them why you're doing what you're doing. Then you've got to cut it off. And there's no guarantee that it's going to work. But it's all you got. If there's anything that will work, this will be the only thing that'll work. But I'll tell you right now, in many cases it doesn't work because it's too far gone. You know, many parents by this time have lost the option of any credibility. Now the kid, they've allowed the kid to use them so much, it's like a kid or a guy or a gal who becomes addicted to drugs. They've used the drugs so long, they can't get along without the drugs. And when they can't get the drugs, they'll steal everything they can to buy drugs. It's like the alcoholic who gets so bent on alcohol that he can't quit. And so he'll do everything. And when you try to take that alcohol from him, he will find a way where he either drinks hair tonic or motor oil. So it's the same thing. You've enabled them to such a degree that they cannot function now without an enabling. And it becomes a problem. And the only way that you can do it is to do it biblically. But again, by that time, in many, many cases, you just like the alcoholic and the drug addict, their addiction is too strong. And their addiction to somebody doing everything for them has gotten so strong in their life through the enabling process. They just shut up and pull away and, you know, and just blame you for it. And that's just the way it is. So that is a great test case for many scenarios.
So what I'm hearing you say, you turn the child over to the world. You still keep an open line of communication, but you got to hold to the biblical truth.
If you can.
If I can.
And the key there is you made one mistake. You said turn the child over to the world. Child's already in the world.
Yeah.
You're not turning him over to the world. You're turning him over to the devil.
Okay.
And your prayer becomes, God, let the devil kick him 6 ways from Sunday that we can get him back. Because that's the only chance you got. And God orchestrates the devil. He did with Job. He did with Abraham. He does with everybody. And so you said, hey, Lord, I don't know what else to do. You know, I know I've screwed up. I made my mistakes. I'm trying to do what's right. Too much water under the bridge. I know this is fundamentally my fault, but I need your help here because all I got now is this. So I'm going to claim 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 5, and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to turn them over to Satan for the destruction of the flesh. And you let Satan do whatever he's got to do to bring that child back and then claim that. And then, yeah, keep the line of communication open if you can. But the problem is, by this time, usually the lines of communication is, I want you to do this for me. I need this. I can't pay this bill. I can't do that. And then so your lines of communication slowly blur right back into your enabling. And that's where the problem comes in. These people by this time are so caught up in the enabling process, they can't function without it. So when you say keep the lines of communication open, many times it's a one-sided line. Give me what I want. And then they'll start to barter with you. Well, I'll let you see my grandkids. That's what this kid, this situation was. If you do this, if you pay this bill, if you give me this, you know, I'll let you see the grandkids. And he was one of the sweetest little kids on the planet. God only knows where he's headed now. But it's life. And it's a thing where, you know, people who cannot make the hard calls in life are going to have some heartache. You know, people don't like to make the hard calls early on in life with their kids, but I'm going to tell you something right now. Making the hard call early in life will save you a lot of heartache later in life. Just that simple. So, a lot of scenarios to it, but that is a model right there. That's a model. And it's an extreme process. I wouldn't want any parent to have to ever go through that, but unfortunately, sometimes they do. Sometimes it comes down that, you know, and I've said this before in people ministry, sometimes when it comes down to dealing with situations with people, there's no right thing you can do sometimes. Your right option's been taken off the table. Sometimes all you can do is the best of two wrong things. And I know that sounds, but that's the way it works sometimes. You get somebody that's so screwed up in their life and so far down, they can't, you know, doing what the Bible says is not an option. You have to go to the extreme, and this is certainly an extreme, though this is what the Bible says to do here. So, yeah, there's messes people get in. Boy, I'll tell you, I've been there with them many, many times. Try to help them through it, but got to be strong with it. It's the weakness that we've had that put us into that situation. At some point, you got to buck up, cowboy up, and you got to do what you got to do. So. Oop. Wow, where'd this hour go? Man, that was like a good night's sleep. Closed my eyes, 10:30, and next thing you know, it was 6 a.m. Well, great questions tonight. I'll tell you what, this is super. Good deal. Let me make a couple announcements here.